Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Hello and welcome. I'm Barbara Sari, the Associate Vice Chancellor for Undergraduate Education and a longtime faculty member of the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry here at the University of California, San Diego. UCSD is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year, and tonight it's my pleasure to be your host for this special series honoring that milestone, UCSD at 50. UC San Diego got some welcome news earlier this anniversary year. In its latest survey, the National Research Council put UCSD's Biological Sciences program in first place, beating out the doctoral programs of more than 200 research institutions across the country. Steve Kay, Dean of Biological Sciences, shares one reason why UC San Diego earned this distinction, with a glimpse into translational biology.
Fundamental studies in biology, what are often referred to as discovery biology, are absolutely essential to every branch of medicine. We're quite used to a term that's used, translational medicine, how discoveries made at the bench are moved to the bedside. I actually believe in a similar concept that can be viewed as translational biology. That is, where do the original ideas come from for what's gone wrong in a certain disease and how we can treat it? What's really critical now is to have the right biological hypothesis, the right intervention point. If we can understand the exact molecular intervention point inside of an organism, we can cure the disease. We can correct that disease at a molecular level. That's how we're going to develop the most advanced types of medicines, is by starting off with the right biological question to answer. We've chosen to gather some of our faculty and their research resources into research centers. One such research center is the Center for Neural Circuits and Behavior, the CNCB. The next level of understanding in neurobiology is really going to come from understanding the incredible complexity of the brain. And it's by understanding that circuitry that we're really going to provide new opportunities for treatment of neuropsychiatric disorders and new treatments for neurodegenerative disorders. One beautiful example comes recently from the laboratory of Professor Nick Spitzer. It has been long thought that once our brain has developed, the individual neurons within our brain have a defined identity that doesn't change for the life of the organism. But Professor Spitzer's research has completely turned that idea on its head. They found by exposing a model organism, in this case tadpoles, to different light conditions, that the chemistry of certain types of neurons and neuronal circuits can actually switch from one type of chemical signal to a different type. And it's staggering because it tells us that the brain is even more adaptable than we thought. It could well be that the types of discoveries that Professor Spitzer is making is going to be very relevant to something like an affective disorder or neurodegenerative disorders like Parkinson's. A few years ago, we established a very different kind of center here at UC San Diego called the Center for Chronobiology. All organisms have a very fundamental type of biological clock ticking inside of them, what we call a circadian clock. In my own lab, for example, we've begun to examine how these biological clocks work in the liver. And we made a very surprising discovery. One of the molecular cogs of our own biological clock is a protein called cryptochrome. Now, interestingly, cryptochrome was first discovered in plants. And what my lab was able to recently show is that this protein actually controls something that we call hepatic gluconeogenesis. That is, how much sugar the liver makes when an organism is being fasted. What we've discovered in experimental animals is that when biological clocks go wrong, the animal tends to develop diabetes. In other words, there is a very tight connection between the biological clock that works in our liver and our fundamental metabolism. And we think that this is going to provide new opportunities to treat diabetes. For example, we found in laboratory mice that if we manipulate the amount of this clock gene cryptochrome, if we just turn up the cryptochrome gene a little in the livers of these mice, we can give a great benefit to the animal in terms of handling glucose levels. So what this tells us is that there is going to be a whole new path for how we can discover diabetes drugs. We now know, perhaps, that if we can identify drugs that can manipulate cryptochrome levels in the liver, this will provide us a new opportunity to develop treatments for diabetes that, rather than, for example, injecting insulin on a daily basis, will go to the fundamental defect in that disease and correct it. That's what I mean by having the correct biological hypothesis. Another cluster of research that we have ongoing is that of the field of immunology, which really is understanding at its most fundamental level how our body mounts a defense against disease. Well, work that is ongoing in the laboratory of Professor Stephen Hedrick is designed to answer that question. T lymphocytes are incredibly important in fighting disease. They are, if you like, really our most effective killers of foreign material inside of the body. T cell levels can be increased 10,000 times over the resting state in response to an infection. But we don't want those T cells to be around forever. We want them to do their job, clear the infection, and go away again. And so Hedrick's work has really discovered some of the molecular triggers inside of these T cells that are responsible for setting the right numbers of these cells, how quickly the cells divide and develop, but also how quickly the cells go away again. They've been able to identify the exact molecular switches, the brake pedal for lymphocyte development. And so when they inactivate the brake pedal, what they find is a massive overproliferation of T cells. And in the laboratory animal, that proliferation of T cells leads to the types of diseases that we see from an overactive immune system, that is, inflammatory and autoimmune disorders. Once again, we foresee plenty of new opportunities for developing medicines for these types of diseases. If we can really identify treatments that hone in on the molecular components that our biologists are discovering, then that's going to be the path by which we're actually going to come up with disease-modifying treatments, treatments that get to the heart of the disorder and are truly providing an opportunity for a cure. It's also going to be important for new types of therapies for cancer. Increasingly, we're recognizing that one of the greatest allies we can have in trying to treat a tumor inside of a patient is the patient's immune system. And if we can discover drugs that can manipulate the patient's immune system so that their own immune system can be turned against their cancer, that's going to be a very powerful new type of way of treating cancer. So Hedrick's work is going to allow us to come up with new strategies for an incredibly wide range of diseases, going from infections all the way through to inflammatory disorders and cancers. I'm incredibly proud to be the leader of a division that has the type of faculty and students that we've talked about. And I think if you were to stop in any of the labs and ask these researchers where they see the future, I think what they would tell you is they see a very bright future in terms of how fundamental biological knowledge is more quickly being translated to the bedside.
I'm Dan O'Brien, and I'm the head baseball coach at UC San Diego. We're a very scrappy team. We love to get dirty. We love to hustle on and off the field. And this is good, solid baseball played at the purest form, and it's just a lot of fun. Last year we were 54-8. It was the dream season. We ended up having 6 All-Americans. We had 3 guys earn gold gloves, which is only given to one player in the whole country at their position. Ended up going to the College World Series for the 2nd year in a row and went straight through the winner's bracket to the national championship game, which was nationally televised. Our guys played exceptionally well and represented the university with class and professionalism. But more important than all of that, our number one pitcher who started in the national championship game is a pharmaceutical chemist. And our number two pitcher is an engineer major. Our number three pitcher is an international studies major. These guys are students first and ball players second. It's pretty cool that they're national championship caliber ball players, while at the same time, some of the best students in the country. So it's the perfect balance of academics and athletics. I was a pretty good player, but I was definitely the guy in the dugout that was keeping the guys motivated and making sure guys were on their toes and holding guys accountable. So to be a student athlete here and then to be an assistant coach and then to get an opportunity to be the head coach at a pretty young age and build my career here at a place that's also my alma mater is just, it's just incredibly rewarding. And I think it's helpful to the guys to know that I've been in the classrooms that they've been in, and I have a pretty good idea what it takes to be successful here, not only as a ball player, but also as a student. And I really love baseball, and I love coaching, and I love trying to come out here and finding ways to outcompete other teams and win ball games. If you're going to take a risk on the bases, take it with one out. But think about that. You have to be telling yourself that in between innings. Other than just trying to catch your breath, you actually should be trying to talk to yourself about baseball. But think about it.
But my true passion is life skills development, and it's why I'm in coaching. And essentially, I feel like I'm using the game of baseball to help prepare our guys for life after college.
Don't lose. Refuse to lose. Refuse to lose. Nice. Good boy.
The Stuart Collection is an ongoing program commissioning contemporary artists to come to the campus and think about doing a project that will somehow relate to what goes on here. We take the proposals to our advisory board, which is composed of people who have spent their lives thinking about contemporary art. And when that group approves a proposal, it's my job then to integrate it with the campus and to raise the money. We do not use any university funds or student funds for these works. I raise the money for them all from scratch every time. The UCSD Stuart Collection is unique. There are some commissions that go on at other universities, but as for ongoing programs, there are very, very few.
Because we have this extraordinary campus to work on. It's possible to work within this community and derive the benefits of the talents that exist here to help artists develop ideas that wouldn't find a home in the normal public sphere.
We now are working on our 18th project, which is very exciting, by Dohosa, and we expect to start construction on that in the next few months and hope to have it completed by the end of 2011. Matthew is overseeing the production. Doho is in London or Seoul or New York, Seoul, Korea or New York or wherever he is. He approves every move that we make in terms of what the work is going to look like, but we can figure out how to make the roof waterproof, how to make the garden grow, how to get the house, build the house and get it up there.
We assisted him in developing this idea, this amazing idea for a house that has sort of magically come down from the sky and attached itself to the upper stories of a modernist building here on campus.
Or been ripped from the ground.
Or been ripped up from the ground and levitated itself up there. That idea evolved from a very straightforward sketch, a very simple sketch that he provided to us. And it was our job, really, our task, with Doho, who came back to visit. It was through that sort of collaboration that we finally found a site. And that site actually evolved into not just a little house that was attached to a building, the side of a building, but it became part of the roof of this building, or sort of attached itself to the roof of this building so that the house could have a front yard. It was a house that was tilted at a fairly severe angle. Now the house remains tilted at this fairly severe angle of about 10 degrees, but the floor of the house will actually be at a lesser angle of about 4 degrees. So you'll be able to stand on the floor without being too much thrown out of balance. But standing on the floor, that floor will be at a different angle from, obviously, the world around you, and also at a different angle from the house that you're standing in. And so you'll be looking through a crooked window at a crooked world.
He came here to go to the Rhode Island School of Design and to Yale after that, and he felt totally displaced, and he felt like he had to find himself again. Many students have been through a kind of displacement or left their home for the first time and come to this place where there isn't anything resembling a home. You can go now into this little house on this building and goes out, and because the house is sort of cantilevered off the edge of the building, you get an intense feeling of displacement, which, you know, is kind of scary. I mean, I'm nervous about the experience of going out there, but I think that's the part of the point. And from the house, you know, 7 stories up, you'll be able to see a lot of the other housing on campus, be able to see out beyond. I think it'll be an unforgettable image as well as an amazing experience. I always say that this is not about taste. It's not about decorating the campus in a cosmetic way. It is about providing experiences for people to think about. You know, some people respond and some people won't, but the fact that they're there and the fact that people remember them, these are all memorable images or memorable experiences, means that they come back to students in ways that they didn't think about, I think, when they were here. Art is really about paying attention, and that's what we all need to do in the world in order to understand the world that we live in.
It's not just the faculty that make UC San Diego a world-class university. As Kim Barrett will tell you, the professors have some help.
Simply put, graduate students are the engine that gets research done at any major research university, and so UCSD is no exception. They are the students who are in the labs, out in the field, doing the scholarship, doing the creative work that moves our campus forward as a research engine.
As the Dean of Graduate Studies, it's Kim Barrett's job to look out for those students by helping with housing or funding, or in the case of a young student like Ignacio Lopez, enrolling him in a summer course to prepare for a PhD program in biochemistry.
I'm the type of person who gets really bored. So I always have to be doing something, working on something. And for me, like, to have the opportunity to come to UC San Diego early during the summer and to just start at 22, it gives me something to do. You know, as I said, I'm here because I'm fascinated about, you know, the chemistry of these tiny molecules that are involved in function of our body and disease.
Ignacio is one of about 4,000 graduate students here at UC San Diego who, as Kim Barrett sees it, will contribute to the public good.
The students that we are training here will be the leaders of tomorrow. They will be leaders in their disciplines. They will be doing the research that creates new jobs, that generates new companies, that cures diseases. Everything that we can think of that comes out as a benefit of that research is what we're training people to do. Graduate education is also about training the next generation of professors. And we cannot renew our universities without generating those people who have not only the ability to do wonderful scholarly research, but also to be inspiring and effective teachers for our next undergraduate population.
Among those who intend to use her graduate degree to teach is Rebecca Salzer, now pursuing a Master's of Fine Arts in dance theater. As a longtime dancer and choreographer, Rebecca was drawn to UC San Diego by its embrace of multiple disciplines.
When I was looking at straight dance programs and talking to the directors of those programs, I would often ask, you know, can I take design? Can I take directing? Can I take acting? How could I connect to your theater department? And usually I got responses that amounted to, you won't have time.
But she did have time here, and 3 years of study led to a master's thesis film exploring her lifelong struggle to correct her vision.
It's a strange amalgamation of dance and documentary and personal narrative and design. It's very loosely about the possibilities and the limits inherent in the way we see. I have very limited 3D vision, and I've been learning to see better in 3D and actually changing my perceptual experience. I hope that the dance is a way of kind of manifesting the ideas and emotions in a nonverbal way. The dances themselves are an exploration of the experience of seeing. It's an interesting balancing act to be a mom and a wife and a graduate student. Having all those other commitments kind of really makes you distill what it is you're here for, what it is you need to get, and it just hones your focus.
Graduate students now compose about 15% of UC San Diego's student body, but Kim Barrett would like to see that number grow in the next few years, a task all the more difficult as education expenses continue to climb to as much as $250,000 per student for a doctorate in science, prompting Barrett to join others in a campus-wide campaign to raise private money for graduate fellowships.
Fellowship support is really wonderful for a student because we want them to have the time to be creative, to think about their research, to really focus 100% of their energies on that. And a fellowship does exactly that. It comes with no strings attached other than the student work hard on progressing in their studies.
Hi, my name is Ayana. I'm a marine biology PhD student at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and this is my office.
She's an absolutely marvelous example of interdisciplinarity because her research has encompassed some very classic marine biology and looking at fisheries and so forth, but intersecting that with policy.
Curaçao is a really amazing place. It's in the Caribbean, right off the coast of Venezuela, about 30 kilometers north. The reefs there are still not doing well compared to what a really healthy reef looks like. The population of large fish is incredibly small. There's basically nothing big left on the reef, no sharks. I think in 250 dives that I did there, I saw one shark and it was dead in a gill net. So as far as the balance of different parts of the ecosystem, there aren't really any predators left on the reef. My research was trying to understand how to prevent things from getting worse, and in fact, how to make them better if possible. And so what I focused on was how science, both natural and social sciences, can be brought to bear on developing a management plan for the island. Fishing is something that's a very strong tradition there and is going to continue. So the question is, how do you minimize the negative aspects of that? It turns out if you put an escape gap about 20 by 2.5 centimeters in the side of a trap, you can reduce the catch of unwanted fish by about 80% without at all affecting fishermen's incomes. So it's one of these rare win-win opportunities for fishermen and for conservation.
Ayana Johnson defended her PhD thesis earlier this year and is now Dr. Johnson, clearly with no regrets about this career path. And for Rebecca Salzer, she'll finish her MFA this spring. And Ignacio Lopez, well, he's just getting started.
The lab I was working for during the summer had a lot of parties.
But so far, so good.
So I'm living in the new Rita Atkinson apartments. They're really nice. Everything's brand new. And it gives me an opportunity to get to work really close because they're on campus. And they're like actual apartments. I hope to be cooking a lot more than usual. You know, cooking is a little bit like chemistry.
One of the main misconceptions is that graduate education is simply a private or a personal benefit to the student that's involved. Graduate education is a public benefit. It's the intellectual engine that is providing for well-being and the security of the economy in our state and the country, and just the discoveries that will make life better for everybody.
Among the many celebrations marking UC San Diego's 50th anniversary was IDEAS, a week-long gathering of innovators in medicine, education, social justice, and science. Of particular pride was a program with four of UCSD's Nobel laureates, each recalling the path that led to his prize-winning breakthrough.
So even a smart pirate knew that he was supposed to diversify.
Actually, several other research groups had asked the same question, and they concluded essentially that nothing would happen. We came to a different conclusion.
And this turns out to be the central paradigm of finance. Which risks are worth taking and which ones are not? If there's no risk, financial markets don't really work.
These colors then form labels that we can tag just about any protein you want, or any cell within an organism, or even an entire organism if you can genetically modify it. We can watch its life history.
In the coming weeks, these talks will be presented in full on UCSD TV. The last day of IDEAS featured an expo with hands-on exhibits and demonstrations to inspire those whom we hope will be future Nobel laureates, who will trace their intellectual awakening to their undergraduate days here at UC San Diego. I'm Barbara Sari. Thank you all for joining us. We'll see you in June for the final edition of UCSD at 50.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.